Subsequent to my conversation with Dr. Ilson, the FDA approved the combination of ramucirumab and taxane as second-line treatment of advanced gastric cancer. I next met with Dr. Eric Van Cutsem, and to begin, we discussed management of colon cancer, specifically the issue of adjuvant therapy.
Stage 2 is the most difficult to discuss because the outcome of patients with stage 2 is improving and is already quite good. But we still use the concept of high-risk stage 2 versus low-risk stage 2. So we take into account different factors, which is the number of lymph nodes that are found. We consider that at least 12 lymph nodes have to be found. If there are less than 12 lymph nodes found by the pathologist, then we put the patient in a high-risk group. Differentiation grade, patients with a poorly differentiated tumor do worse. Obstruction at the initial presentation, stage 2 but with T4 tumors, then tumors with lymphatic vessel invasion, perineural invasion, vascular invasion, young patients and patients with an elevated CA. These 8 or 9 criteria that I mentioned bring the patients into the category of high-risk stage 2. And then on top of that, we have now the MSI status, with patients with an MSI tumor being a good prognostic factor, MSS tumors being a worse prognostic factor. So an MSI tumor, stage 2, without any of these poor characteristics that I just mentioned, we will never treat these patients. We will discuss that the benefit of adjuvant chemotherapy is very limited. In an MSS patient with an MSS tumor, with one or more of the poor characteristics that I mentioned, then we will discuss for an adjuvant chemotherapy of 5-FU or capecitabine. Usually we don't offer them oxaliplatin in the adjuvant stage 2. Oxaliplatin is officially not approved. There may be some exceptional cases where we give 5-FU plus oxaliplatin in stage 2. That's a very young patient with several of these poor prognostic characteristics with an MSS tumor. So for instance, a young patient with a T4 tumor with vascular invasion with 6 lymph nodes involved, we will discuss with this patient that there's no proof, but that there is some evidence that oxaliplatin plus 5-FU may be beneficial for him. So that are some of the different characteristics. A balanced, fair discussion is always necessary with the patients. The benefit is limited, 3-5%, but there are some patients who want to go for a 3-5% benefit for adjuvant treatment. So it's always an open discussion that has to take place in this situation. For stage 3, it's a bit more easy. Most of the patients with stage 3 colon cancer are offered adjuvant 5-FU oxaliplatin treatment for 6 months without biologicals. That's a standard treatment in this situation. One of the important discussions is whether we should offer that to all patients with stage 3. One group of patients especially is, there are some controversial data on the 70-plus patients. I think the age on itself is not a crucial decision factor. The age is one of the factors, but it's also taken into account the concomitant pathology of the patient, concomitant diseases he has. A 75-year fit patient without any concomitant pathology and diseases with a clear stage 3 colon cancer, I will offer him 5-FU oxaliplatin. But there may be 70-year-old patients with a T2 and one tumor with poor kidney function, with a myocardial infarction, with a physiological age that is clearly above 70, I may offer him only 5-FU. So that are some of the differentiators in this setting.
Could I just clarify, in terms of the elderly, is the issue that the tumor might be different biologically, therefore the patient doesn't benefit from chemo? Is it the issue that somehow they're not able to receive an adequate amount of therapy? Or is it just that other comorbidities will take their life before you can see a survival benefit?
I think it's the 3 factors that may play. Other comorbidities, they may not end up with a treatment, and who knows, the biology in very young patients. There are also some data from the ACCENT database that young patients with metastatic disease at least have a more aggressive biology in colon cancer, so probably also in the adjuvant setting, but that's not so clearly proven, but that's what at least we think. So it's 3 factors. And there an open discussion and a clinical judgment is important. That's not always easy just to discuss on a file. You have to see the patient, to discuss with the patient if he's 73, 74, to see what he wants. Also how he looks like, how physiologically he is, and to take into account the different comorbidities.
So when you think about the algorithm you just laid out, I'm curious where you see the current and also the future role of multi-gene assays like the Oncotype DX or Colaprint, you know, fitting into this decision-making paradigm.
At the moment in Europe, we don't use them so much. There are only a few exceptions where they're being used. They have a prognostic role, but they are not predictive for 5-FU or 5-FU oxaliplatin. We still lack some data. There's, however, increasing evidence that they may also play a role in this algorithm in stage two, for instance, in these different factors that I just mentioned. They're also mainly prognostic, but we base our decision for a treatment on that, although the different factors that I mentioned, the classic old-fashioned factors, are more prognostic. They're not proven predictive, but we still use them in our clinical decisions to predict a benefit of a treatment. The same is with these gene signatures, which are being used more in the US, and I believe they have some utility, but in Europe they are not reimbursed in many healthcare systems because of the lack of proof of predictive value to show that a patient with a certain gene signature has more or less benefit from a treatment. We know that they do better or worse in general, regardless of the treatment, but in relation to the treatment, which is a definition of predictive factor, that's not yet proven. And that's why in Europe, we're a bit more conservative with these gene signatures than some oncologists in the US. I believe in 5 to 10 years, or probably faster, that we will integrate them much more. There is some work ongoing in this regard to try to prove the predictive value, but that's not yet there. We don't have yet the information.
So a lot of investigators bring up this quote issue of lack of predictive benefit. But the other argument that I've heard is even though there's not a different hazard ratio in terms of the benefit of chemotherapy, high versus low risk, for example, with the Oncotype, that there are data that the relative risk reduction is about the same, and then theoretically, you actually can predict a different absolute benefit. I've heard people say, you know, a few percentage point one way or the other. Agree or disagree?
I agree with that, and I acknowledge that the fact that they're not so much used in my country as well as in other European countries is that they're not yet approved, these different gene signatures, by the authorities, and especially also in countries. Our healthcare system is much more social, and healthcare systems, and for patients, patients want to have their medical diagnostics being reimbursed, and that's not yet the case always. So that's why we sometimes, some European, if we are honest, some European key opinion leaders hide themselves a little bit behind the fact that the level of evidence is not the highest level of evidence yet. We have some, as I mentioned earlier on, some indirect evidence. I'm convinced that this indirect evidence and the different pieces of evidence are accumulating and that we will be using that and that the science will drive us, even if the authorities don't approve it in short term, that the science will drive us and that we will find creative solutions also in our healthcare systems.
Let's talk a little bit about management of advanced disease. And I want to ask you where we are today in terms of expanded RAS testing. What do you do in your own patients and what do we know about the impact?
Expanded RAS testing is mandatory, I think, for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. The evidence is all going in the same direction as well, the preclinical evidence, the biology, as the evidence, the retrospective analysis from the different trials. And we have always to be careful with retrospective analysis. But if everything is going in the same direction, and if that's consistent with the biology, then we can and we should believe that. That's also why EMA, the European agency, has changed the labels of cetuximab and panitumab, not to have them approved and reimbursed only for patients with a KRAS wild-type tumor, but also for a RAS wild-type tumor. So it's mandatory to do that for different reasons. One, if we do it, we can increase the likelihood of benefiting from an anti-GVR antibody, and the same is true for as well cetuximab as panitumab. So we increase the likelihood of responding. Two, if we treat a patient with a rare RAS mutation, we may harm the patient, especially if he's treated with oxaliplatin-based therapy. The data with as well cetuximab as panitumab for the combination of oxaliplatin plus panitumab or cetuximab show that there is a deleterious, a harmful effect if we treat a patient with a rare RAS mutation. So that's a second reason. A third reason is also self-evident, is that we save money for society. If you don't treat a patient who will not benefit, so it's an economical advantage. And a fourth argument to do the expanded RAS testing is that if we don't expose the patients to the toxicities of the drug, I'm not talking on the harmful, the show or survival, but the toxicity. So there are four important arguments to do the RAS testing. It's widely spread right now. I wouldn't say it's in every hospital in Europe today already expanded RAS testing, but it's advancing very fast. The label is there. The label change is implemented now, and it's being done.
So I'm curious about your thoughts about the much anticipated CALGB80405 data set that was presented by Alan Vanook at ASCO, and then there was some subsequent data presented at the ESMO meeting looking at response rate. Can you talk about what the study looked at, what in your mind were some of the key findings, and what you think it means?
This is important study, important data set, initially presented at ASCO, later updated at ESMO GI in Barcelona at the end of June, and then at the ESMO meeting at the end of September. A couple of important lessons and messages. One, the survival of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer is becoming longer. It's reported that it's close to 30 months. It's not the only trial. We see also some other trials where it's around 30 months. If you go back to the 5-FU era 15 years ago, the median survival was 10, 11 months. So now we are up to 30 months. All with incremental different steps, we're making it longer, the survival. So that's an important message.
Could I just ask how much of that do you think is lead time bias from better imaging and more aggressive imaging?
Small part, probably. I don't believe the majority is lead time bias. I think there may be, of course, a little bit with the screening, earlier diagnosis of metastatic disease, smaller tumor burden, so that more patients can go on to different lines of treatment. I don't believe that in colon cancer, this lead time bias is so important. Then if you look gastric cancer, Asian patients versus Western patients, more Asian patients get a second and third and fourth line treatment compared to Western patients. And that's probably due to the fact that Asian patients are diagnosed earlier on with lower tumor burden. In colon cancer, this may play a small role, but I don't believe it's a major role. I do believe it's more the strategic thinking, exposing patients to the different agents that we do have, the different strategies with the cytotoxics, with the targeted agents. Also the thinking of multidisciplinary approach, going in some patients after resection of liver and or lung metastasis if they are resectable. So all these different aspects probably contribute to the improved survival. And usually every time that we see integrated a new drug, we see that a small step to 3 months with a median survival. So it's an incremental benefit in this setting. And we are now around 30 months. And this is a confident number that we can mention to our patients. So I do believe that that's one of the important messages of the CLGB study. The second message is that the CLGB study did not confirm the FIRE-3 study from Germany and Austria. FIRE-3 study, which showed that the survival of patients treated with cetuximab was longer than the survival of patients treated with bevacizumab in combination with chemotherapy. The CLGB study did not show that. The CLGB study tells us that we have different options. We have the option of an oxaliplatin-based chemotherapy. We have the option of an irinotecan-based chemotherapy. In theory, we can combine that with bevacizumab or with the anti-EGFR antibody. Every option is possible. Also, we can combine oxaliplatin with the anti-EGFR antibody, which was taken out of the NCCN guidelines after the CLGB study. It is brought in again in the NCCN guidelines as it is in the ESMO guidelines. So the different options are there. The CLGB study, for me, didn't change my standard practice. I treat most of my patients, regardless of RAS status, in first line with oxaliplatin plus bevacizumab. The anti-GVAR antibody is given in second or third line. So I still do that after the CLGB study.
So I'm curious what's new in terms of second line therapy, particularly in the RAS wild type patient. I saw there's been some updates of the ML818147, the continuation of Bevo and progression study that you were involved with. Aflibercept is still out there, EGFR inhibitor. Can you talk about today how you're approaching the patient who starts out on FOLFOX Bev, maybe has a response, does well for a while, goes on 5-FU Bev maintenance, and then has progression? How do you approach this, and how do you factor in those and other alternatives?
Well, in clinical practice, in most of the patients, and the example that you gave, patients started first-line FOLFOX Bev, having some benefit, and then after some time, 6 months, 12 months, progression. Usually we, and we're talking on the RAS wild-type patients, we will give them in second-line FOLFIRI bevacizumab, the post-progression continuation of bevacizumab, based on the TML study, that post-progression continuation of bevacizumab improves the survival and improves the progression-free survival. Another theoretical option could be aflibercept, but aflibercept cross-trial comparisons is a bit more toxic, has a bit more side effects than bevacizumab. So we reserve aflibercept for patients with a very fast progression on the first-line FOLFOX-BEV. The patient treated for 2 months with FOLFOX-BEV, he has a progression, he's symptomatic after 2 months. I will not continue usually with FOLFOX-BEV, but usually I will give this patient, also if he's RAS wild-type, FOLFIRI, aflibercept. The anti-GVAR antibodies may benefit also some patients, but the incremental benefit or the relative benefit is as big in third line as in second line. In the strategic thinking of continuum of care, we usually give the anti-GVAR antibodies in this situation in third line. So often the option is first line FOLFOX-BEV, FOLFIRI-BEV in second line, if there was a reasonable time to progression in the first line. And then the third line may be irinotecan plus cetuximab in these patients. In a fast progressor, it may be FOLFOX-BEV, fast progression, then FOLFIRI, aflibercept, and then the anti-GVAR antibody in third line. That's the usual algorithm in this regard. We don't have head-to-head studies, not phase 3 studies of anti-GVAR versus anti-VEGF antibodies in second line. We have a small randomized phase 2 study, which is not conclusive, but we don't have head-to-head studies in this regard. So we base a bit our decisions on the thinking of the continuum of care and also on some safety aspects for BEV versus aflibercept, this choice. We would love to have, of course, more biomarkers for aflibercept versus BEV, but we don't have them and we will not have them in the near future in this setting. And we will not have head-to-head studies neither in the near future. So I think this second-line strategy and this decision pattern based on clinical aspects is quite stable and may stay there for some time. And it's not going to be changed probably in the near future because no new trials in this situation are to be reported in the near future.
So you presented positive data at the ESMO GI meeting on a phase 3 trial in metastatic CRC of TAS-102, a fluoropyrimidine. What is this agent and what did you learn about it?
TAS is a new fluoropyrimidine which was developed in Japan. It's a different mechanism of action. It's a combination of two drugs that comes from Japan. And our Japanese colleagues reported beginning of this year or last year in the Lancet Oncology randomized study, randomized phase 2 study, chemorefractory patients pre-treated. They randomized these patients between placebo plus supportive care or TAS-102 plus best supportive care. And they reported a survival benefit with limited toxicity. Of course, with fluoropyrimidines, you have to be always careful. We have seen some examples with S1, different pharmacology between Asian and Western patients. That's why there was, in parallel with that Western phase 1 program, to look at recommended dose. And then we did very fast a global study that I had the privilege to co-chair with Bob Mayer from Boston and Atosho Otsu from Tokyo. And I was in the European PI, where we treated and randomized more than 700 patients between chemorefractory, similar situation than the regorafenib trial. Almost 20% of the patients were pretreated with regorafenib, around 80% of the patients were regorafenib naive. And we randomized the patients between best supportive care or TAS-102, 2-to-1 randomization.
And I assume these people had had plenty of fluoropyrimidines.
These people had plenty of fluoropyrimidines. They were treated different lines with fluoropyrimidines. They were refractory to fluoropyrimidines also. The mechanism of action is different from this drug than from the classic 5-FU. And yeah, interestingly, and I must say to the surprise of many of us, we found that there was a clear, relevant, statistically significant, but also clinically relevant benefit. There was an improved survival, there was an improved progression-free survival, there was no improved response rate. And the nice and beauty thing is that there was very limited toxicity. The most frequent side effect was neutropenia, but on the other hand, only between 3 and 4% of patients had neutropenic infection. So the neutropenia that was clearly more frequent with TAS-102 did not lead in many patients to neutropenic infection. And for the rest, there was virtually no difference between placebo and TAS-102 in the toxicity. I can tell you that looking into the data, that they're robust. We will see some further subgroup analysis being presented at the ESMO meeting in Madrid in this regard. But that's a new drug for patients. And at the ESMO GI meeting in Barcelona, there were two new drugs for patients with GI cancer. That's this TAS-102 for colorectal cancer, and the liposomal irinotecan second line for patients with pancreatic cancer. There was a second line trial, 5-FU plus liposomal irinotecan, which showed a clear survival benefit also in second line pancreatic cancer in GEM pretreated patients. So that's the good thing, that this year we have seen two new drugs. The phase 3 study with TAS-102 was more robust. It was larger than the liposomal irinotecan trial in pancreatic cancer. But both treatments are important, and we will see further updates at ESMO meetings and at the ASCO meetings next year. But they are very important, and they will offer us new treatment options for patients. And in Japan, by the way, the Japanese authorities have recently approved TAS-102 for marketing in Japan. So the drug is available in Japan, and I'm pretty sure that it will be filed and submitted for approval also in the US and in Europe.
Same for the liposomal irinotecan. You think that's going to be filed also?
I expect that that should be filed, yes, because second-line pancreatic cancer, we don't have approvals. We have a couple of options in patients in first-line, gem-nab-paclitaxel or FOLFIRINOX. For the gem-nab-paclitaxel patients, this is clearly an option, and I don't see a reason why it should not be filed. The trial is a bit less robust. It's a bit less big. We saw initial presentation at ESMO GI. We have to see a bit more on the subgroups, but if there are no surprises coming out of that at the ESMO presentations and so on, then I expect that it will be filed also.
I wanted to ask you about regorafenib, but if TAS-102 were approved, how would you use it, if at all, and would you use it before or after regorafenib?
Difficult question where there is no formal answer right now. There are no head-to-head studies. The relative benefit hazard ratio for regorafenib versus placebo or TAS-102 versus placebo was very similar. The median survival benefit was very similar, compared favorable even for 102, but in general we can say that it was very similar in this setting. The safety profile for patients with TAS-102 was better than for patients with regorafenib. In the TAS-102 trial, as I mentioned, around 20% of patients were pretreated with regorafenib, but I don't believe that that should be a predictive factor for benefit of TAS-102. We have to work on regorafenib on the dose. The official approved dose is under 60. That's what we still have to do in Europe, but I'm sure that we will fine-tune that. This will push us also, this TAS-102 data will push us to do some more trials with regorafenib to fine-tune the dose. What is the optimal starting dose? 80 or 120 milligrams, and then to increase the dose. If we can come up with better strategies, we may also reduce the toxicity in this setting. And then I don't have that thing that we can say formally which drug we should use before the other drug. Therefore, we have to see a bit more data in this. I think both will be options for patients. That's a bit similar to the question for patients with a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. What is the best first-line strategy for targeted agents? Is it everolimus or is it sunitinib? Both have approved against placebo to benefit patients. We use both drugs for patients with pancreatic NETs. We will do the same for patients with chemorefractory metastatic colorectal cancer. The promise for TAS-102 in the future may be also, and there are some phase 1 studies ongoing, to combine it with other cytotoxics. If we can find an adequate dose, recommended dose with the adequate safety profile in combination with oxaliplatin, in combination with irinotecan, it may go more upfront at a longer term. But of course, we need to phase 1 data. We need to see whether the more than 30% neutropenia grade 3 and 4, which was not a problem as single agent, when that's combined with irinotecan or with oxaliplatin, if we come up with a cumulative hematologic toxicity, whether that's not going to lead to problems or whether we can administer the full doses of both agents. So there are still some challenges and still a lot of work for us who are doing clinical trials.
We're hearing a lot about the issue of toxicity with regorafenib, and you've talked in the past about the fact that the trials and the way the drug is approved, the patients now are heavily pretreated. Can you talk a little bit about how you think that contributes to the toxicity? And also, I was just listening to an interview I did with George Dimitri, and he was talking about regorafenib and GIST, and his feeling was that it wasn't as toxic because the patients had already gotten sunitinib, so they already had a VEGF-TKI. Somehow their body got acclimated to it. What's your vision about what's going on with these toxicities that you see with the VEGF-TKIs?
Difficult question where there's no straightforward answer. I think the fact that patients with colorectal cancer are pretreated for a longer time than the GIST patients with more different agents, with more aggressive chemotherapy, may contribute to that. However, the toxicity that we see is slightly different. It's not mainly bone marrow toxicity. It's the hand-foot skin reaction, which is an important problem for patients treated with regorafenib. But clearly, the poorer general condition, the more pretreatments may play into that role. I don't think pharmacokinetics in these patients should play an important role, colon cancer versus GIST tumors. But the factors that you mentioned probably play an important role into that. And also the poorer general condition may play a role into that also. Whether it's the fact that patients are used a little bit already to a TKI, to VEGF-TKI such as sunitinib, or whether that's the selection of patients, if they didn't tolerate sunitinib in second line, and just that physicians may not have put them on the trials or not offer them in clinical practice regorafenib if patients were really not tolerating sunitinib, whether that's also contributing so that it's a favorable enrichment of the population, that may also play a potential role in this situation. That's not yet clear. But it's true that in patients with GIST, the safety issue is usually less important than it is in colorectal cancer. And therefore, as I mentioned, it's crucial, it's important that we fine-tune the schedule and or the dose of regorafenib. Until now, the registration studies were with 160 milligrams, 3 weeks per day, 3 weeks out of four. Many of my US colleagues and friends start with 120, some even a little bit lower. In Europe, many physicians still start with under 60 milligrams. That's because in some countries where it's not yet reimbursed, it's approved, but not yet reimbursed, that we are using the drug in an expanded access program and that we have to stick more strictly to the label. But I'm sure that the market and now the competition with TAS-102, that will drive some of the projects looking to the better adapting the dosing and the regimens for the patients in colorectal cancer.